Welcome to this spectator event, Trump the First 100 Days. And we filled the hall tonight, as you can see. Indeed, it was sold out about a month ago, which is a testimony to our readership and to the interest there is in the United States and Mr. Trump. Trump the First 100 Days, we know, is something of a mechanic, has become a feature of American presidential early days. It was popular with FDR. He had a lot to do in the first 100 days. JFK was quite keen on it as well. And Mr. Trump was pretty keen on it, at least when he was campaigning. Maybe now in power, not so much. It's one of the things we'll talk about. So what I want to do tonight is to use the first 100 days to talk about what he's done and what he hasn't done. And then, though, to use the first 100 days to try and divine what the next 100 days and the next 100 days after that will be of his presidency. We have brought together a superb panel. Piers Morgan, journalist and broadcaster. Bonnie Greer, playwright and columnist for the New European newspaper. Ted Malloch, professor at Henley Business School. Steve Erlanger, the London bureau chief for the New York Times. Colleen Graffey, former US Deputy Assistant Secretary of State. And Michael Gove, of course, MP for Surrey Heath, landed the first British interview with President Trump. That's our panel tonight. Give them a round of applause. Now, in Mr. Trump's first 100 days, he made 145 speeches, 28 of them with teleprompter, which meant his aides didn't have a heart attack. He's had 9 news conferences, but only one solo. The other 8 were all with foreign leaders. He's given 32 interviews, 9 to Fox News, 17 golf outings, 17 other meetings with foreign leaders, 28 flights on Air Force One, 30 on Marine One, that's that amazing white-top chopper that the president goes around in. He's made 15 domestic trips, none west of the Mississippi. He's made 0 foreign trips. He's visited 11 states. He's made 7 trips to Mar-a-Lago, which is becoming the Southern White House. He spent a total of 25 days there. He's spent 0 days in Camp David, which is the presidential retreat in Maryland, which Jackie Kennedy once described as like a motel in Arkansas. So maybe that's why he prefers Mar-a-Lago. He's got 28 bills into law, though not all of them very significant, and he's issued 30 executive orders, some of which have fallen foul of the courts. That's the raw statistics, but what has he actually achieved? Ted Malloch.
Well, thank you for starting with me. The last time I was with you, I was driving around in a red Cadillac in Parliament Square, and you got me to say some very facetious things that got me into a great deal of trouble. So I thought I'd start instead, as you have, with the numbers. So you can't dispute the facts. 29 is the number of bills signed during the first 100 days, the most since Harry S. Truman was president. In fact, when I was born, so a long time ago. 32 executive orders signed, the most in 72 years. 136, in fact, it was 136 years ago during the presidency of President Garfield, long ago forgotten, when the Supreme Court justice was nominated within the first 100 days. Of course, he achieved that. 2 trillion, not a small number. The stock market is up 5.5%, its gain in dollars in the first 100 days. Also noticeable is the consumer confidence polls, which have now scored their highest level in 40 years. And finally, I think most significantly, 97. A recent poll last week, 97% of Trump voters say they will vote for Trump again. In fact, coming down on the stairs, Piers and I had a conversation, and neither of us would take the other side of the bet. President Trump is all running for re-election in 2020, and the slogan of that campaign will be, "Keep America Great." In other words, a certain assumption. So we're off and running. 100 days is arbitrary. It is an FDR standard. I think political scientists if you want a scientific point of view, would say it's better to judge a president after the first year, not after 100 days. But I think we've already seen a president who is going to be actively engaged.
Steve Erlanger.
Thank you, Andrew. It's a pleasure to be here. His accomplishments, I would put down first as getting Neil Gorsuch onto the Supreme Court. Second accomplishment, firing Michael Flynn, which was a great benefit and boon to the world. And probably the third great accomplishment is listening to Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis and calming down a bit on issues like NATO and China. We can go through the things that trouble me, too.
Give me one of these, and then we'll come back to many more.
Well, the thing that bothers me most is we've never had a president with such a loose association with the truth. This is a man who, you know, boasted when he built Trump Tower. He told his press guy, just tell the press it's got 68 stories, not 58 stories. What's the difference? And that's something that has stayed with him all the way into the White House.
All righty, we'll come back to a number of these issues. Colleen Graffick.
I would say his number one achievement is Supreme Court Justice. Number two achievement, Supreme Court Justice. Number three, Supreme Court Justice.
It so he's appointed three.
Yeah. that is how important it is. It was absolutely critical. I think many Republicans who were not automatic supporters of Trump voted for him for the Supreme Court justice position. And it shows the wisdom also of the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell in holding off to ensure that if a Republican got in, that they would have a Supreme Court justice conservative to replace Scalia. But second, I would put that he has assembled a very impressive foreign policy team. I worked at the State Department in foreign policy, and the Secretary of Defense, Mattis, Tillerson at State, and McMaster's as National Security Advisor. They are good, solid foreign policy individuals who I think for many out there that were concerned about his foreign policy are much relieved and excited that he has brought them on board. I'd also put on there that his response to Syria was heartening for those that felt that when Obama said there was a red line that would be crossed and it was crossed and he didn't do anything and that America would lead from behind, that when Americans saw Trump taking the action that he did in Syria, they thought that was a very good thing for American leadership and to change the road that America had been heading down. I'd add one other thing, which is that consumer confidence is up. We have some bad returns on the economy at the moment, but the whole view that there is someone that actually wants to bring jobs back to America, that actually wants to reduce corporate taxes, why are headquarters, Google, eBay, others overseas when they should be in America? So bringing jobs back home, increasing consumer confidence, and also his focus on cutting red tape and regulations. So I think that whole package has been heartening.
Michael Gove.
There's a saying, not just in D.C., but here as well, that in politics, personnel is policy. And on that level, Trump has both been a massive disappointment, but also a reassurance. Massive disappointment? Well, certainly to his base and to people who placed great faith in him, because he has been the slowest president in recorded history when it comes to filling his administration. And because, as we all know, in America, the top ranks of the civil service are appointed by the president in a way that is not true here, having your men and women, having your people at every level of the bureaucracy is necessary to drive forward your agenda, whether that agenda is malign or benign. And Trump has been remarkably slow in doing that. Partly because his rhetoric of draining the swamp was all about moving away from the revolving door that saw people move from lobbying firms and think tanks into government and then back out again. He wanted to avoid being drawn into that DC swamp and instead appoint people with professionalism and expertise from outside politics. And his failure, therefore, to have good people, or indeed many people, in many of these departments has meant that he hasn't been able to push forward his agenda at the speed or with the competence that he might want. However, as several of my fellow panelists have pointed out, when he has made appointments, he has made some surprisingly good ones. And in that sense, in the words of one former Reagan staffer whom I talked to in D.C., Donald's presidency... Ronald McDonald. Big Mac. Donald's presidency is much more a reversion to mean, in both senses of the word, than people imagined. He's actually governing in foreign policy terms much more like a conventional Republican. And his rhetoric of America first, during the campaign and at his inauguration, may have led many of us to fear that he was going to be a Charles Lindbergh-style isolationist. The truth is that he's far more in the mold of pre-Second World War Republicans, or even someone like Eisenhower. He's not someone who, like George W. Bush, believes in a vision of democratizing the Middle East, but he's also not someone who believes that America should retreat from the world. He's very touched and moved by the model of Andrew Jackson. And Andrew Jackson defined a role for America which is looking after its own interests, but when they were threatened, hitting back hard. And it's a militaristic and at times bold vision, but not one that seeks to recast the world in America's image. And
doesn't it concern you that he thought that Andrew Jackson could have stopped the Civil War, even though Mr. Jackson died 16 years before it started?
Well,
and left power 24 years before it started.
I think I know what he meant, which is that... And I may be unique in this respect.
Well, you probably know more than him, then.
About Andrew Jackson, I suspect I do, but certainly not about becoming a billionaire. But the thing I would say is that I think he thinks that the spirit of Jackson, had it survived, might have averted the Civil War. Who knows? Historical speculation. But I do think that, as a number of my colleagues have pointed out, appointed people like Tillerson and Mattis and indeed H.R. McMaster after the mistake of appointing Mike Flynn as National Security Advisor, they're all very establishment Republican figures. He's taken advice from people like Henry Kissinger and indeed the Bush senior team about these appointments.
All right.
And that makes him, in foreign policy terms, more conventional than we might have either hoped or feared.
I will pursue a number of these issues, and I'm going to start with foreign policy in a minute. It may be that Mr. Trump had in mind the nullification crisis of 1832, when South Carolina declared federal tariffs null and void, but Mr. Jackson then threatened to send in the federal army, which is exactly what Mr. Lincoln did over the Civil War, so I'm not sure there's a great difference. But never mind, that's your lesson tonight on the nullification crisis. It's now null and void. Bonnie Greer.
Donald Trump has achieved a couple of things that have been fairly unprecedented in American history, certainly in the presidency. He's achieved the lowest approval rating on the Gallup scale since it was invented, which is quite extraordinary because this is the honeymoon period for an American president. It's quite extraordinary, and people would be talking about it for a long time and how he managed to achieve it. His job approval rating is very low, except among his partisans. He has his followers are 98%. I call them followers, are 98% approval rating. The rest of the American people are not. He published, and I just want to read a bit of it. He published a pledge signed by himself with his very famous scrawly hand signature, which I wouldn't want to actually be the person to analyze that, in which it began with, Trump pledged to do the following in his first 100 days. Now, you have to keep in mind that Trump himself brought up the term 100 days. No one else actually did, but he bragged about it. I just want to give two or three things that he said that he pledged to do for the American people. He pledged to appoint judges who will uphold the Constitution and defend the Second Amendment. He did get Neil Gorsuch approved, and my colleagues, my opponents here, are absolutely right. But he had to do it what's known as a nuclear option, which means that this judge, I believe, and I, I, I stand corrected, is the first judge ever appointed to the Supreme Court without, I think, the correct...
And the Democrats had proposed that.
Exactly, they did. They did, absolutely. But it was the option in which he didn't get in on basically a partisan vote. It was a straight majority. So that puts him in a very interesting position. Of course, he's got the job for life, but that's the way he got it. He promised to construct a wall on the southern border of the United States of America in the first 100 days. And I've got this here on paper. He hasn't managed to do that and isn't actually listening to even some of the governors and officials on the border who are saying it's not necessary. We also don't know what the wall will be. Will it be a wall, or will it be a series of buzz and whistles? We don't know. He promised in his first 100 days to repeal and replace the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare. And as I was leaving home, it was reported that the vote that was supposed to be taken this Thursday on whether they were able to bring this to the floor probably won't happen because he doesn't have enough votes. Now, what's extraordinary about that, ladies and gentlemen, is that the president has control of both houses of Congress. He promised to push...
Just one more.
Okay.
Because I don't want you to use all your ammunition right from the start.
Well, I've got a lot of things to say about this guy. That will not happen.
We knew you'd come well on.
He has managed to achieve the very interesting record of not going abroad in his first 100 days, and he hasn't even gone west of the Mississippi River. That's Donald Trump.
All right. Thank you for that, Bonnie. Piers Morgan.
Well, that was fascinating, wasn't it? Because Bonnie was not able to name a single achievement by Donald Trump.
I did name them.
What was the good achievement?
I didn't say good. He said, I was asked, Andrew asked me. Andrew said achievement. Andrew said achievement.
We will come around to, I'm sure, debating
this
point.
Oh, right. Well, I just wanted to get that straight.
Yeah, but it sort of plays into the narrative that I've always had about this, which is that I wouldn't have voted for Donald Trump myself. He's not really my politics, but I predicted in a number of columns in the campaign period that he might win, because I was spending a lot of time in Florida and Texas, and I was getting a feeling of a completely disconnected America, where LA and New York were just out with the fairies. Never imagined in a million years that Hillary Clinton could lose. And Trump won, and they were all sent into anaphylactic shock. And as a result, they just lay on their backs, kicking and screaming and wailing from Los Angeles to London. And they've carried on doing this, and they're not prepared to give Trump any credit for anything. Let me go back to the New York Times, since we have one of their most erstwhile men here. New York Times said this, despite the...
Erstwhile.
Do you know something Steve doesn't? Is he going?
Exactly.
He's going to Paris, he told me earlier.
Yeah, but for the New York Times.
Yeah, but he's still moving, right? I mean, New York Times said this, despite the best efforts of the White House PR apparatus to sell the president's first 100 days as a success, the New York Times declared in editorial the new administration has in fact been plagued by many missteps, including a bungled sales job on his first major legislative initiatives and a snakebit confirmation process, all of which have produced a flurry of articles bemoaning the lack of focus in the White House. The first 100 days, the Times concluded, is a period the president might prefer to forget. Well, that wasn't about Donald Trump. That was about Bill Clinton in April 1993. But they reassured their readers then, it's still early, and 100 days doesn't really mean very much. 100 days can be very explosive for US presidents. In Abraham Lincoln's case, civil war started. In JF Kennedy's case, the Cuban Missile Crisis. Truman dropped an atomic bomb.
Harrison died.
Ronald Reagan was shot. Right, others have died within 36 days. Actually, by American presidential standards, you may not believe this, it's been relatively calm under Donald Trump.
Now, if you're Mexican.
In terms of his achievements, the reason that the Gorsuch appointment is so important, not just because they played a nuclear option which changed all the rules, but because it does mean that for the next three decades, it is very likely that the Conservatives will have a majority in the Supreme Court. And that is probably the most significant victory Donald Trump will have in his entire tenure. I think it's significant that a 70-year-old man is the most explosive and successful exponent of social media on the planet. And I speak as one of the 42 people that he follows on Twitter. and the only Briton that he follows on Twitter. Sorry, Michael. And
I'm just updating my profile now.
I also speak as somebody who I was a contestant on the first season of Celebrity Apprentice, which I won. And and Donald Trump's last words to me, and you can Google this, just before he made me the winner, were, "Piers, you're ruthless, you're mean, you're tough, you're possibly brilliant, I don't know, but you beat the hell out of everybody, you're my Celebrity Apprentice." So I sent him a copy of this when he won, saying, "Donald, you're mean, you're tough, you're ruthless, you're possibly brilliant, but you beat the hell out of everybody." And we are in unique times. Donald Trump is like nothing you've ever seen. It's horrifying to some people. It's exciting to others. But there can be no doubt after 100 days, he's not the monster that the critics predicted he would be. I defy anyone to point to anything he's actually done. I'm sure Bonnie will try very hard. Which would be classified as Hitler-esque, as we were told he was going to be. But nor has he been the Messiah. And it is early days. And I would urge people with Trump, and it's been said a lot, but it's really important. As someone who's known him 10 years pretty well, he's a guy that you should definitely take seriously because he's the most powerful man on the planet. But he's not a guy you should always take literally. And that might sound absurd. You might think we have to take him literally. He has to be a conventional politician. But he's never going to be. This guy is never going to be the president most people in this room might want him to be. But that doesn't mean he can't be incredibly effective. And it doesn't mean, and we had this chat on the way in, that I haven't had a sneaky bet on Trump being re-elected. Because until the Democrats stop screaming and wailing and find a candidate that they actually beat this guy, as opposed to the most qualified disaster in the history of American elections, Hillary Clinton, who lost to a guy who hosts The Apprentice, until they do that, then Donald Trump is here to stay, and you will be talking about several thousand days at the next Spectator debate.
All right. We've had the opening remarks from our panel. Let me begin on foreign policy. For clarification, in Kennedy's first 100 days, he faced the Bay of Pigs disaster in Cuba. The Cuban Missile Crisis came later than that. On foreign policy, should we not be concerned about a president who calls President Erdogan in Turkey to congratulate him for basically abolishing democracy, for describing Kim Jong-un as, quote, a pretty smart cookie. And for inviting the president of the Philippines to the White House, a man who, according to Human Rights Watch, has assassinated 7,000 people in his anti-drug war. Should we not be concerned about his seeming obsession with the strongman, Ted Malik?
Well, one can be concerned. I think you have to view Trump as the realist that he is. He's not an ideologue, so he's not a neoconservative. He's really not on either end of the political spectrum. He's all about, and his favorite term is, common sense. So to comprehend him, you really have to understand that he is, I use the term, it's a management term, a kind of service leader. He wants to lead the country based on his definition of service, his understanding of patriotism, and that means engaging the world in all of its parts. I was listening to, I guess it was CNN, should I admit that, the other day. Trump doesn't listen to Clinton News Network, but they played back a tape that said Obama was actually willing to meet with all these various foreign leaders. And the list was long, and a litany of people just like the one you just mentioned. So why should Trump be any different? We have to engage the world. I think he's not running away from it. He's not the isolationist he's been painted out to be. And he's taking on the world. He's engaging. In a sense, you could say Trump is like a train going down a track. And there's another train going down the same track. And President Trump is actually changing the presidency and the presidency is changing Donald Trump. When it comes to foreign affairs, I don't think he's going to be the misanthrope or the Mao leader that he's been painted out to be.
Colleen Graffy, you were in the State Department. The invitation to the Philippine leader went without the State Department being informed or consulted, and the National Security Council wasn't either. Is this the proper way to make foreign policy?
Well, for a normal politician, no. But what we have here is someone who approaches things with a businessman's sense and a showman's style. And he's looking at, what do I need to do to achieve my objective? And for example, with Turkey, the United States needs Turkey, NATO partner, with what is going on in Syria, Philippines with regard to North Korea. So whilst we might lament the fact that he's not publicly condemning them for human rights violations, we certainly hope that that's being done behind closed doors. But we also have to look at the bigger picture, Syria and North Korea. To your point also, one of the criticisms I would have is that he does need to fill those foreign policy positions. And it is a problem when you have close to 500 Senate confirmed positions that have not yet gone through or even been nominated. And he might have good people in place, but unless you have the team underneath them, it's hard for them to actually push the foreign policy forward. So we hope that in the next 200 days, all that will be organized and set up.
Michael Gove, you pointed out that in a number of initiatives on foreign policy now, Mr. Trump looks more like a conventional American conservative than the sort of radical right candidate that he ran the election. But why is that a plus if you campaign on one thing and then do almost the exact opposite? I mean, we understand that NATO is now no longer obsolete. We understand that China is not going to be named as a currency manipulator. We understand Germany is not going to be named as a currency manipulator. And he's intervened in Syria. He's decided that it looks much more difficult to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem than he thought. Why is it a plus to have gone back in almost everything on these foreign policy fronts that got him elected?
If his original positions were wrong, mistaken, or self-harming, or bad for the world, then it's a good thing that he's learnt on the job. I'd rather that someone who was supremely well qualified to be leader of the free world were in the White House. But if you find someone in that role who, exactly as Colleen says, has the style of a showman, then you hope that he will, as a shrewd businessman, put people around him from whom he can learn and also adjust to take account of reality. And I think you're absolutely right to say that it corrodes faith in the democratic process if you say one thing and do another. And it's also the case that for those of us who take human rights seriously, it's unseemly to see someone like Duterte potentially being entertained in the White House. But if you are dealing with what's happening in a rough neighborhood like the Middle East, then you do sometimes have to make some uncomfortable, not alliances, but some uncomfortable accommodations. Ditto in Southeast Asia. And I think one of the things that drives Trump is that he sees that there are certain disruptive or revolutionary powers or states, Iran, North Korea, and then there are certain other states which can be on the side of stability, whether that's Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, or Japan and the Philippines, and he decides that he's going to have very good personal relations with those individuals. And one of the things that Trump has done throughout his business career is learn from mistakes, never admit publicly he got things wrong, but change course. And the other thing that he's also done is that he has prized personal relations. The telephone call, the squeeze of the elbow, the sharing of some truly delicious chocolate cake. All of these things help cement his agenda and help make things work better for him and for his team.
Steve Erlanger, is it a plus or a minus that in whatever he says, in terms of policy and those he has chosen to carry out the policy, it's more like a conventional conservatism?
Well, he was just described as a realist. I just wish he had a better grasp of reality. I mean, he's a very ignorant man in terms of history and diplomacy and foreign affairs. He's a businessman. He's used to doing deals. He runs the country a little bit the way he ran his company. He trusts his family. He trusts his lawyers and his accountants. Everyone else is a servant and is expendable. It's a bit mafia-like. And it's very narrow. And foreign policy is not just about personal relationships, as Theresa May found out in Washington. Foreign policy is about credibility. It's about trustworthiness. It's about alliances. And the United States built a post-war order that has protected the peace by and large, has protected Japan, has protected Europe, has created multilateral, multinational institutions that have worked pretty well. And if you have a president who says, I'm America first, who sees everything as transactional, who sees his alliances as transactional, that means they're not permanent. That means they go up and down. That means they're not trustworthy. I mean, that means they're dependent on what this guy thinks at any given moment. And as we know, at 2 a.m, he tends to think odd things and tweet them out happily. So I think this is what bothers me. Oddly, I think his instinct on Russia was correct, that for the first time since probably 1917, the West is not supporting the whites. It's not trying to change Russia. It's not trying to tell Russia what to do. It's simply saying, you can treat your people any way you want. You can be as big jerks as you like. But what are your interests and what are our interests? And let's talk about those. Because I think there is work to be done. There is something to be done about Ukraine. There's help needed from Russia on North Korea. I don't think the Philippines is very crucial to North Korea, but China and Russia certainly are. There are all kinds of issues of terrorism and drug movement where we actually need a relationship with countries we don't particularly like. Now, I am relieved that he's decided for the moment not to throw out the Iran deal. I mean, I'm relieved that for the moment he's decided that NATO is no longer obsolete because of him, for some reason. Everything changed, apparently, with NATO in the first 100 days. I'm relieved that he hasn't moved the embassy, because otherwise we would have, from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, otherwise American embassies would be burning all over the Arab world. And I'm relieved that he trusts his generals. But it is worth saying, you know, that he has a bromance with dictators. Yes. And that is troubling. And it is also troubling, as smart as these generals are, generals have blind spots. I mean, where's the civilian authority? I mean, he asked for a special leave to have Jim Mattis, who I think is a good appointment, to serve as Secretary
because
of Defense.
The gap between being in the military and then...
Yes, precisely. And in principle, that bothers me, though I think Mattis is, you know, an extremely good choice. So what worries me is, you know, the impulsiveness of the man. You can control him, but offend him too much. You know, if you're not Ivanka and you're not Jared, you might be gone in a minute.
Let me come to Piers, then to Bonnie. Piers, a bromance with dictators?
Well, the list of dictators that Barack Obama invited to the White House is long and illustrious. Go and Google it. It's pretty similar to the list of dictators we've given state visits to in this country just before we all began marching about the horrifying Donald Trump. And we weren't as horrified when Robert Mugabe got the old queen carriage. We weren't as horrified by King Salman in Saudi, you know, where they still stone women to death. We weren't bothered about the Emir of Kuwait, where it's imprisonable if you're gay, I think 6 years you get for being gay in Kuwait. We quite welcome these people on red carpets and give them the golden carriages. But somehow Donald Trump, a business guy from New York, is the worst of the worst. And when it comes to trust, you know, let's look at Barack Obama. I'm sure everyone in this room would be, what a great guy. What a great president. It put me in the perfect idea, right, of a president that you could completely trust, right? This is a guy who, when in 2013, Bashar al-Assad unleashed chemical weapons and killed 1,300 people, including 400 children. He said, you know, months before that, if he uses chemical weapons, that's my red line. President of the United States. And so he used them, killed 1,300 people, And Obama did absolutely diddly squat. Nothing. Now that, to me, is a heinous breach of trust. Donald Trump, when confronted with exactly the same set of circumstances, acted immediately and proportionately, in my view, showing me that he listens to his generals, who my brother is a British Army officer, he's met both of them, says they're two of the most impressive people he's ever met in the world's military, which I'm encouraged by, I'm reassured by. But when it comes again to trust with Obama, my favorite question for people is, how many illegal immigrants did Barack Obama deport in 8 years? You know what people guess in Britain? I don't know, 1,000? 10,000? I mean, he's a nice guy, wasn't he? I mean, Trump's a monster. 3 million people were deported from America under Barack Obama. I don't know how many people in here knew that statistic. I didn't see any marches about it. I didn't see any fury. I didn't see Bonnie Greer exploding on Twitter in outrage. So I wrote a book around the time that Obama was elected, and I said I would have voted for this guy if I was American. I loved the fact that he campaigned so vigorously that 90 times on camera he said he would, first action, he would shut Guantanamo Bay.
Are we discussing Trump?
Yeah, let's
or
get off.
Well, wait a minute.
Let's get off the morning sofa, yeah, Piers.
The Trump critics don't like what they call whataboutery. Whataboutery. You know why they don't like it?
Nobody.
Because
why don't you answer the question?
It wasn't a question.
Why are you talking about Obama? This is about Trump.
Bonnie, stop screaming. You've been screaming for 9 months now.
Let's talk about Trump.
I could just finish.
So what is the answer? The question was,
I wanted to make
does
one.
He have a bromance with dictators?
I understand the question.
Thank you.
I understand the question. And I'm responding to both the hypocrisy generally about presidents and queens sucking up to dictators for expediency, but also on Obama, to finish my point on that, is that Guantanamo Bay is still open for business. So when it comes to pragmatic presidential or pragmatic presidents, I don't think Trump's any different to any of the others. I also think that he is, at his heart, a businessman. He negotiates. All the way he played China, I thought, was great business. He terrified the life out of them in the campaign about one China and the rest of it, about Taiwan and so on. And then he invited President Xi to Mar-a-Lago, gave him some nice chocolate cake, and while he was eating the cake, told him he was blowing up Syria. But he and Xi seem to me to have a very good relationship.
All right.
Xi, to some people, is a dictator, right? Just as much as Erdogan is. So, you know, it's pragmatic presidency, and I think it's correct.
The test of that, of course, will be what pressure China brings to bear on North Korea.
Right.
And on that, we don't know anything yet. Bonnie Greer.
We haven't resorted to anything ad hominem toward this panel, but since Piers is always selling soap, and he thinks it's the morning, obviously, that's where he's got to go. You have no idea what I was doing on any march, so you need to be quiet. Now, let's talk about... Let's go back to...
You don't know anything about it.
Let's go back to...
You don't know anything about it.
Bonnie Greer.
Let's go back to Andrew's original point. It's a very good original question. I think the most alarming thing about Trump's foreign policy, and I'm listening to most of this panel with the exception of one person, who are fairly grounded and intelligent about this. And I'm listening. And I'm listening to the tone. And they may not be aware of it. It's we hope, we think, we don't know, we kind of hope he's this, and all these different metaphors, as if we're talking about some kind of superannuated crown prince who's suddenly been elevated to the top of the kingdom. We have no idea about who he is, what he is, and what he's going to do. All presidents are like that, and I have to agree with Piers on that. But this president, we particularly don't know anything about, and he doesn't want us to know
anything about him. Picking up that point, let me put a question to you, because if he is unpredictable, it does make it difficult for his critics. I mean, the Democrats spent much of the first 100 days pushing the idea that Trump was in collusion with Putin. And that went up in smoke after the missile strike with Syria. So the unpredictability, and of course Nikki Haley in the UN, she blamed the Russians for not controlling Assad. She was directly nailed the Russians. And Jim Mattis in Afghanistan said when he was there that the Russians were actually arming the Taliban. So well, having the Democrats having built up this, he's in Putin's pocket, he's in the Kremlin's pocket, we really can't trust him on this. Suddenly that narrative gets blown to smithereens.
Well, I'm not here to, I'm not a Democrat, I'm not in any political party. So
no,
I'm
but you see my, the point.
Yeah, I do see your point, but my point is there's unpredictable and there's unpredictable. It's the difference between living next door to someone who's going to take care of your lawn and someone who you don't know is going to burn up your lawn, and you're not sure about that. We need to have some idea of a foreign policy direction from this president. What we do know, and I think everyone, almost everyone on the panel has said, he likes strong men. This seems to be where he's heading for. Well, I suppose if he can keep these strong men in control, maybe have a strong men coalition, a strong man conference, or they can have chocolate cake in Mar-a-Lago, that would be a good thing for the world. The other thing Colleen said that I think is very important, and we need to talk about in a serious way, and I don't know if this is still the case. Trump recalled every last one of the ambassadors of the United States of America.
It's done every time.
But hang on, at once. At
Always
once.
Done the
no,
same
well,
way.
No, it was. No, it isn't, because I know someone who wasn't. And and everyone at once was recalled. I don't know yet if they are in place. I'm not sure. But I do know that the State Department is a microcosm. It is a ecosystem that also runs the foreign policy of the United States. And that this particular president has announced, and I think it was 2 days ago, that he is no longer in conversation with the former president of the United States, and I'm not sure if he's in conversation with any of the former presidents of the United States, should be something that is alarming, because the president learns from other presidents. You don't have to do what they say, but you learn. And this man isn't doing any of that. So, you know, I don't think he's the evil troglodyte of all time, but I would really feel much more assured if somehow he had some of the systems that we've been used to in terms of running the foreign policy of the United States in place. He has a very inexperienced man at the helm of state. He is good at selling oil, but we don't know if he knows anything else about diplomacy. And so he has a lot of novices in his administration. It would be good if we knew
all right.
Somehow connected.
Just to give you some breaking news, Hillary Clinton has given an interview, blamed the FBI Director James Comey and Russia for derailing her path to the presidency. I was on the way to winning, she says, until a combination of Jim Comey's letter on October the 28th and Russian WikiLeaks raised doubts in the minds of people who were inclined to vote for me but got scared off.
Anybody to blame apart from Hillary Clinton?
How much did she get paid for the speech?
No, it's an interview with CNN.
She did it with Christiane Amanpour
right
now.
We've heard
correct.
It. It's 1,000 times.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Okay. I just given some news. I don't want to analyze it. We're here to talk about Mr. Trump. Ted Malik, why was NATO obsolete 100 days ago and is no longer obsolete now?
The reason, in a word, is because Donald Trump, at a certain point in his campaign, made sharp criticisms of NATO and said they need to be fighting the next war, not the last war. They need to refocus on terrorism and cyber issues. And he met with people at NATO, including the Secretary General of NATO, and they have actually begun to change their way. He had an effect on the future of NATO already in the first 100 days of his presidency. And most importantly, Andrew, what he said is that people will pay their fair share of the burden, that we are not going to pay all of the expenses, that the 2% rule, which is part of the club rule at NATO, has to be part and parcel of the American policy going forward. Only five countries out of the group pay their fair share.
But first of all, NATO has always been involved in anti-terrorism in modern times and on cybersecurity. And we don't have no evidence that the budgets have been redeployed as a result of Mr. Trump's intervention. But on the 2%, which of GDP to be spent by NATO countries. There's been a long complaint of America that not enough do that. He said only five countries, including this one. What is the evidence that any country, particularly Germany, has decided to change its spending on defense as a result of Mr. Trump?
Well, he had a bilateral meeting in the White House with Chancellor Merkel. She made a conversation and said we're going to move more rapidly towards that goal. She said it could be met in the year 2020, which is too far off in my view.
Not in the but campaign. She's not
she is
that.
Moving in the right direction. Germany's at 1.34%. 1.34%. Now they're going to move to 2%. They say they'll do it by 2020.
Well, in the election campaign that Mrs. Merkel is now fighting, she says she won't hit 2% till 2024, which was the policy before Mr. Trump came to the White House. So I'm just at a loss to know what has changed. Are you all, before I move on to domestic policy, generally agreed, though, that despite the unpredictability, that the momentum in American foreign policy is now more with the mainstream than you thought it would be? Colleen?
Mainstream of what?
Mainstream Republican foreign policy.
Yes, I would say definitely so. And to the NATO point, you know, a lot of countries don't even talk about NATO and their NATO partners. And I would meet with diplomats who were really not doing any public diplomacy because it was hard power and they didn't want to talk about something scary like weapons. And they needed to do so. And so what Trump has done by saying NATO is obsolete is get everyone's attention to say, what do you mean it's obsolete? How can he say that? Then just as easily he pulls it back after meeting with Jens Stoltenberg to say, oh, well, I was wrong, it's not obsolete. But it's put it on everyone's radar. Well, why is America paying the largest share? And aren't these countries in Eastern Europe the vulnerable ones that the United States is protecting? And don't they have a reason why their country should be committed to NATO? So by being a bit bombastic, he raises it to the extent that we'd never get
but what was
for
the
any public
in,
diplomacy.
But what was the change in policy?
None.
Okay.
And he said that. He
all
said,
right.
I was wrong, it's not obsolete, okay. And in fact they're doing good things, but countries should be paying. And then when they discuss what NATO does, countries realize, yes, well, why aren't we paying our fair
all
share
right.
on that?
Let me come on to domestic policy.
And that makes it politically possible for budgets and countries to actually do that.
Right, though I know of almost no country that has increased
they have
its
said
planned
so.
Defense spending. But let me come on to domestic policy now before I throw it open to our audience. Michael Gove failed to get the Obamacare reform through, partly scuppered by the Tea Party wing of his own party, and now has moved on to tax reform. Obamacare reform may not be dead, but he's moved on to tax reform, indeed trying to clear the way to get some tax reform, and even that is far from certain that it will happen. So where are the... Let's assume you can't do much domestically in 100 days. Let's take that for granted. But where are the achievements likely to be?
Well, that is a very, very difficult question to answer because I think that the Trump team simply haven't grasped yet what's required in order to make things happen on the Hill. There is a fantastic opportunity for the Republicans because they control both the House and the Senate. And it's also going to be the case that it will be very, very unlikely that they will lose the Senate because of the races that come up in 2 years' time. But I referred earlier to Trump's desire to drain the swamp, his aversion to the Washington way of doing things, and the fact that he, during the campaign, ran as someone who was defining himself against those people whose souls had been stained by working in Washington. But if you want to get things done as an executive, you need to have a relationship with legislators. And one of the things that I think the White House team has been brought up short by is the fact that those relationships were not in place. The pivotal role that Vice President Mike Pence will have can't be overstated. There's something else as well. There's goodwill at the top of the House, the congressional hierarchy, towards Trump, but there is also a difference of outlook. Paul Ryan, a formidably intelligent guy, is broadly speaking an economic liberal, even libertarian, and he's someone who wants to shrink the size of the state. Now, Trump make common cause with him on tax and regulation. But one of the reasons that Trump won is because he said, I'm going to protect your entitlements. And I'm not going to do what these balanced budget Republican hawks want you to do, which is to take away some of the healthcare entitlements and to take away some of the Social Security entitlements that you have. And there is a, on one level, philosophical, on another level, political difference between people like Paul Ryan and those on the Hill who want to dramatically shrink the size of the state in order to tackle the deficit, and people like those around Trump, including Steve Bannon, who think we won with a populist, middle American, economic nationalist message, and the last thing that we're going to do is to say to the miners of West Virginia that we're going to take away the benefits that you've worked so hard to secure in your old age.
Steve Erlanger, what do you think his possible achievements will be? I mean, Michael Gove, if he's right in saying that the Republicans among themselves can't even agree on domestic strategy, what's the chance that he will achieve very much?
Well, I do think he does have time. It is too early to judge him on this. Obamacare isn't perfect. He's going to come up with something that he'll get through the Republicans. It will take him longer because he has a right wing that doesn't want much state help. And he has, even on the Republican wing, some people who say you can't take away benefits from people with pre-existing conditions. It's not fair. But they'll keep working on that.
But he said he will guarantee pre-insurance for pre-existing conditions. But the Obamacare 2, if I can put it like that,
yes,
the legislation doesn't really do that.
Yeah. No, but I mean, all I'm trying to say is he will persist with that. He will do infrastructure, which will be very popular with the people who voted for him and which the Democrats will have a very hard time saying no to. He will probably get some sort of tax reform thing through. And he's going to keep pushing on these border controls. I mean, it's in the courts. The courts have thrown these executive orders back. But again, you know, these are promises he felt he's made to his supporters, and he's going to keep going at them. I think Michael's identification of Pence as important is absolutely correct. But the thing to remember about Trump, too, is he won on partisanship. He didn't win on bipartisanship. He won on people's anger. And if he doesn't get done what he wants, you know who he's going to blame. He's going to blame the Congress. He's going to blame Paul Ryan. He's going to run against Paul Ryan and the Democrats and the Congress. And he'll blame us, the media, because we're props in his play. But he is a persistent man, and he cares, to me, much more about domestic policy than about foreign policy.
Piers Morgan, the president has talked about an infrastructure plan, billions of pounds of spending. He's also, although he's kind of lost control of a lot of the detail, they're now looking at a $1 trillion tax reform / tax cut package, which everybody, bar a few economists, think would result in a massive increase in the deficit for the foreseeable future. Mr. Trump built his business on debt. Is he going to try and build the American economy on debt?
Well, I think that the thing to start from with Trump and his domestic agenda is that it's almost impossible to overstate how fractured and paralyzed Washington is. You know, when I was at CNN mainly in New York for 4 years, and covered the last election, it's so intransigent, it's so poisonous, it's so partisan, that nothing ever gets done, even when it's screamingly obvious something should be done. And the one example, after Sandy Hook, 20 school children aged 5 and 6 are blown to pieces in their classroom. 92% of Americans in all the polls supported universal background checks to prevent these loopholes where 40% of all the gun trades in America are done without a background check. And they couldn't even get that passed because the Republicans were so determined to screw over Obama that common sense was never going to come into play. And Trump is now hitting the same problem with some of his own party, but obviously the implacable Democrats returning fire with fire and that kind of favor with favor. So the question then becomes, can someone like Donald Trump, a non-politician, a businessman to his veins, can he do a better job at deal-making than somebody like Obama, who came in on this huge wave of optimism, massively high opinion polls. Bonnie's quite right. Trump's very low. Obama was very high. Obama ended up a lot lower. And Trump, I suspect, will end up considerably higher than he is now if he can deliver on a reasonable new tax plan. The tax plan, you know, in America is absurdly complicated. You know, if you want to even buy, like, bureaucracy in America is ridiculous. And I love America. It's been very good to me. But you try and buy a car in America, and you'll get this pile of paperwork to fill in. Everything is bureaucracy gone mad. Trump is at war with that. He wants to destroy that. And I'm completely behind him on that. He wants a simplified tax code. He wants a fair and affordable health care act. You know, people can go on about Obamacare until they're blue in the face. The reality is, I supported it. I thought it was a great idea. But the middle classes in America ended up paying through the back teeth for it. And they're not going to tolerate that again. So Trump is facing now the art of the deal. He wrote a best-selling book called The Art of the Deal. And, you know, I would just end with one story that Bill Clinton told me in an interview I thought was really pertinent to this, is that he faced a lot of intransigence with Newt Gingrich and with Putin for a 1.5 years when they crossed. And I said, how did you do business with these people that appeared to be so intransigent? He said, with both of them, it was the same. I said, well, tell me about Putin. He said, well, with Putin, we'd be in a room, and there'd be 30 people on each side, and we'd be getting nowhere, everyone posturing, trying to score points. And eventually, one of us would go, right, bang, out, everybody out. And it'd be me and him, president to president. And we'd go at each other, bang, 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 bang. And at the end of it, he said, we'd reach points of agreement. And then the trick was not to make him lose face. And I said, okay, but the key question then is, did he keep his word? He said, Putin never went back on his word to me when it was one-on-one and we shook hands. Now, deals can be done even with the most unlikely people. And the question, the big question for Trump, to me, is can a deal maker, a real deal maker, do deals up on the Hill that someone like Obama, who was famously not a good deal maker, not a good negotiator, singularly failed to do on many of the things he tried to deliver?
What evidence do we have that he has the ability to do these kinds of deals? I mean, the deal over Obamacare fell apart. He has had to get the government funded for another 5 months.
Yeah, but he's been in power 100 days.
But he's had to give away the store. I mean, the Democrats had his lunch on this deal.
They've had his breakfast. I think lunch is still available. And, you know, I when I wrote my first column about Trump and the day he ran and everyone was mocking him and laughing at him, I said the one thing that would be really, really bad and wrong is to underestimate this guy. And I would say again now, 100 days in, I've seen enough green shoots of Trump on this massive learning curve from businessman to president to encourage me, who would not have voted for him, not least because of his views of gun control and climate change. But I'm encouraged enough by what I've seen that he can potentially be the bull in the Washington China shop who can break through and get deals done. And if he can do that, he will win the next election by a landslide.
I want to agree. Don't underestimate him. We have to remember that Reagan, it took him over 208 days for his signature tax reform, and it took Obama over 368 days for his Obamacare. And I think this was a new administration that didn't realize just how difficult it is to get legislation through Congress. So good for them for trying to get it through, but I think they've learned lessons on what needs to be done in order to achieve it next time.
Bonnie Greer, I think Mr. Trump's future will probably be determined by his ability or failure to deliver to the blue-collar workers that voted for him, to bring jobs to the Rust Belt, to raise their quality of life and standard of living. And it's interesting. And of course, if he doesn't, that is the Democratic opportunity. But the Democrats have done very little to reach out to these people since the election. I thought it was interesting that in the Post, Washington Post, ABC poll, only 2% of people who voted for Trump regretted voting for Trump. 96% still thought it was the right thing to do. So the Democrats have made no start in trying to peel away people who were the natural constituency. Just one other thing. In that poll, only 28% said the Democrats were in touch with ordinary people, which was 10 points behind Mr. Trump.
Well, you know, when you start a church, you're always going to have your followers aren't going to actually go against you. And Trump has started a church. And to go back to what Michael Gove said, which I think was pretty brilliantly laid out, backed up by Steve, Trump is essentially an independent. He's not a Republican. In fact, I've got more Republicans in my family than Trump does. And what's actually was always really shocking to me, I lived in New York in the 80s when Trump was starting his ascent. And when I found out that Trump was running as a Republican, the first thing I said was, a Republican? You know, Trump is, you know, Trump is Trump, okay? That's the party he belongs to. That's the presidency he's running. He has to learn the presidency of Trump. Meanwhile, as I say in the Westerns back at the ranch, we have the world and the country to run. He has to make a compromise, and I don't think he's capable of it, not only because of his age and stage in life, but because he's been a success at doing things his way. Now he's finding out that the country and the world does not run according to Donald Trump. And what we are doing as a people and as the world, we are adjusting ourselves to his time. His 2 o'clock get up at night, you gentlemen of a certain age knows why he's doing these at 3 a.m. We're getting used to that. We're getting used to all of the bits and pieces that make this man up. What I would say to him if I was an advisor, and I didn't think I would ever come and give this dude any advice, but I think that he has to find out, he doesn't have a lot of time, he has to find out what his presidency is about. The questions that are being asked about his are basically questions to his base. He has started a kind of cult. He has started a kind of religion. The Democratic Party, this was a loss that none of the polls predicted. Nothing predicted this. So it was catastrophic to that party. I'm not a Democrat. I have a lot of issues with them. But I think, you know, you have to give them a little bit of time to assemble themselves.
Let me come full circle and go back to Michael Gove before I move out and we'll get the house lights up. Michael, let's just come back to the point that you started with. I mean, you described Speaker Ryan as a libertarian. I would describe him as a fiscal conservative. I mean, his idea of financing the tax cuts was to cut Medicaid, cut Social Security, privatize part of it, cut Medicare, and do other things like that. Throughout the campaign on these issues, Mr. Trump campaigned as a New York Democrat. He never once talked about cutting Medicaid or Medicare or Social Security. That's a pretty big gulf. How do you square the circle with on these issues, a New York Democrat in the White House and a fiscal conservative Republican running the House?
That's the heart of it. And the coalition that that Trump assembled, both in the Republican primary and subsequently in the general election, was a new one. And he ran on the basis that the conventional conservative Republican wisdom, exemplified by the editorials in the Wall Street Journal, was that what the Republican Party needed to do to win was to have immigration reform and entitlement reform. And his view was the exact polar opposite. The Wall Street Journal would argue that Mitt Romney had alienated potential Hispanic voters by his attitude towards migration. And they also argued that economic credibility was key to transforming America for the better. And Trump's view was, no, I can build a coalition of people who are opposed to migration because they see their wages being hit or perceive their wages being hit, and I can also say to them, I will safeguard your entitlements. And that that message, that fusion, was successful. And as a result, it got him into the White House, but it also created a gulf between him and the philosophy of the overwhelming majority of his party.
Okay, let's hear from our audience now. No speeches, but a few points. Can we get the lights up a bit, please, so I can see the hands? There we are, slowly, surely. Now, we've got microphones there and there. Do we have one over there? I'm afraid I can't see. And there's one up there, too. So there's a gentleman right there. We're going to come to you. Keep your hand up. And I'll come down to there in a minute, but let me see one up there as well. the gentleman there, and then the lady down here. Yes, sir.
Thank you. We've heard a lot tonight about efficacy, but some of the most efficacious leaders in the world are the most despotic. We've heard nothing about morality. It seems to me that Trump is patently an immoral man that has disdain for women, disdain for the future of our environment, even disdain for his base, who he knows he's going to withdraw healthcare from and will never give them back steel production. So my question to the panel is it possible to be a good leader if you're not a good man?
Piers Morgan.
Well, the two most popular post-war presidents, JFK and Bill Clinton. Who I would argue with some confidence make Trump look like a choir boy. So I'm not entirely sure, in answer to your question, how much Americans, and bear in mind that's who we're talking about here, the American electorate, how much they really care about Trump and women and those kind of issues. We might want them to care more than they do, but they revere Bill Clinton, they revere JFK, and they were both serial womanizers. One had sex with an intern in the Oval Office, and yet is probably the most brilliant politician I've ever met and interviewed. So I don't know the answer to that question. I don't think it's very simple. I think it's quite complicated. And I think that Trump, from my experience of him, which is knowing him pretty well for 10 years, I've never viewed him as a particularly immoral person. I was as surprised and, upset by the tape that came out, the Access Hollywood tape, as somebody who likes him and, felt that it was obviously very demeaning. But I don't view him personally as somebody particularly immoral. I think he's a pragmatic business guy who loves his family. He's even popular with his ex-wives. I mean, that is extremely unusual. So, I don't think he's the monster when it comes to morality that perhaps that one tape 15 years ago suggested, bad though it was.
Steve Erlanger, immoral?
Well, I'm not a moral judge. And I don't actually, on some level, care. I mean, what I worry about is whether he's a good leader or not. I think there are a lot of good leaders who have not been moral. You might argue that even Stalin during the Second World War was an excellent leader, though you would hardly call him moral. So I think it's like saying, a great novelist needs to be a nice person. I think that often doesn't happen.
I don't think it ever happens, actually.
Leaders tend to have a streak of ruthlessness and competitiveness and arrogance that probably serves leadership very well, but doesn't make them particularly nice.
I'm not going to all of the panel for every question. We'll be here all night, so I'm going to pick and choose. There's a gentleman there, got the microphone, I think. Yes, there. And the lady down at the front here, if you keep your hand up, we can get a mic to you too. Come down. Yes, sir. Have we not given the mic to you? Yep. We're meant to give it to the gentleman there and then come to the lady here.
So many would say that Donald Trump
Hold on, where are you? Where are you? Oh, you're up there. Yeah. Well done.
Over here at the back.
How did you get in?
Through the door.
Well done.
It's quite easy.
That out yourself?
Thank you.
Good.
Do you want me to go ahead?
Donald Trump rose to power as a populist revolt against Barack Obama, whereas Obama came to power as a revolt against George Bush. Would we like to see, and do you think the panel would see, that the next American president after Trump will come from the center?
I have no idea what this president's going to do, never mind the next one. Ted Malik? I think the supposition behind the question, at least the question behind the question, is American politics changed forever with Mr. Trump, or is this just an unusual period we're going through?
Well, of course the answer is we don't know. We have to wait and see. In 10 years and 20 years, in hindsight, we'll be better equipped to answer that question. My sense is that because of the things you've heard on this panel, and I worked in the U.S. Senate for a number of years, bipartisanship is gone. Partisanship is in. It's very difficult, actually, to have anything done on a coalition basis, that we'll probably have the next president will be maybe even farther to the right or farther to the left. That's the extremist wings of the party that are bringing forth these candidates. So the question is, can the center hold? I mean, is it good or bad? You asked me kind of objective question, what will happen? I'm myself more of a centrist or a center-rightist. I would prefer someone maybe more to that side of the axis. But we are having a more kind of extreme conversation in America. And I actually think that's happening around the world. So it's not only in America.
All right. I'm going to move on. The gentleman there has got the mic. Yep, we've got it to you.
Good evening. What are the exact consequences of Trump not appointing the 500 public appointments and the State Department being fairly empty? How has American foreign policy, or any policy for that matter, directly suffered as a result of that, if at all?
Colleen Graffy, it must mean that the State Department is not as important as it was.
It basically means that it's harder for Trump to push any foreign policy forward because it can't just depend on the few individuals around him. For example, Tillerson, he's got the entire globe to deal with, and unless you have an undersecretary and assistant secretaries in place to bring the policy down to individual countries, it's the U.S. government is a big ship, and it turns slowly, and it needs a lot of people in a lot of places to implement this policy. So it is something that has to be done soon, but we have to remember, I think Trump himself was surprised that he was elected, and most politicians have a whole entourage of years and years of political experience of individuals that they know and have already been vetted. So he's starting from a much different position than all other politicians.
Steve Erlanger, can't you... You can't do everything.
Can I answer a question?
I think you've had a pretty good say, and I will come back to you in a minute, but I asked Steve Erlanger a question. Can you maybe not be able to run foreign policy in the details, but surely you can set the strategy and the goals and the direction of foreign policy from the White House?
Well, you can, and of course more and more foreign policy has been made in the White House for years now. Mm. I mean, you have principals meetings where senior officials from the Defense Department, the CIA, and the State Department get together and hassle out policy. And more the National Security Council has grown and grown and grown and has become kind of...
G-R-O-A-N.
Yeah, also that. You can do it, but I mean, you can't ask Jared Kushner to run the world without help, right? I mean, that's hard. He's got Asia, he's got Israel, he's got, all
it's
kinds of things. I'm sure he's very talented, but...
How do we know?
Well,
he ran a $1 billion real estate empire just, in New York.
Yeah, he ran a real estate empire. Exactly.
I mean, look at China. I mean, that's a good example to look at. Now, Trump had this terrible mistake at the beginning with the phone call to the Taiwanese president.
It wasn't a mistake.
It was deliberate.
He did it on purpose. Yeah.
Bob Dole set it up, but not to help Trump, to help the Taiwanese for whom... he works for the Taiwanese, yes. Right? And Xi Jinping then refused to talk to Trump until he reverted to the One China policy. So the first thing that happened was Xi Jinping said, I can roll this guy. Now that was because he didn't have a staff that was paying attention.
You don't know what he got in return.
You're shaking your head.
I'm sorry, with the greatest respect, I think that's a massive misreading of what happened. I think Trump played the Chinese. He quite deliberately made that call. He knew it was going to get out. In fact, it was a wonderful moment when the New York Times was running with a story saying new deep freeze between America and China, and they had to change mid-edition to say that actually they'd just spoken on the phone. And Trump was playing, I think, from what I know of him, a classic business maneuver. He basically went to an extreme position. He knew he would piss off the other guy, and then he reined himself back, and he had a much bigger play going down the line, which is trade, North Korea, and other, to him, more important things than Taiwan, about which I doubt he knows very much. But the idea that this was a mistake and that he somehow stumbled into making a call to the Taiwanese, I think is...
That's one view, Piers.
Yes, it is.
The other view is that Xi Jinping, right, got a get-out-of-jail...
Quite sinister slowness to your tone now, which I'm...
Okay, Xi Jinping got a get-out-of-jail card from Donald Trump on currency manipulation and on trade by promising to do a little more on North Korea.
But we don't know what Trump has extracted from President Xi, do we? We don't. Well, and the reality is he's had him down in Florida. He's had him around with his big chocolate cake, the most beautiful chocolate cake that was ever made in the history of chocolate cakes. Huge. And we don't know what they've been talking about. But my guess with Trump is, as with all the things he does, don't look at the first move he makes, which is always quite extreme, because that's the 68th floor on the 58th floor style. And it's what every real estate guy in New York does all day, every day. Look at where he ends up. I think he's ended up with the Chinese in a pretty good position, a mutually beneficial position, which I would imagine is proving very disconcerting to a lot of people outside of it, because if they can do business together, they're both winners.
Let's see.
But if they do business together, China continues to run a massive balance of payment surplus with America.
Sure.
Which is, but that's what Mr. Trump said he would deal with.
I would not, again, underestimate Trump's ability to do a deal with the Chinese that actually, in the end, benefits America.
Lady down in the front.
Forgive me, because I know we're here to talk about Trump, but there is just one thing, which is if Trump was to fall under a bus tomorrow, we have Pence, and we haven't touched on him. I think we know less about him as vice president than we've known about previous vice presidents within the first 100 years and know about whether or not they would be implementing their president's policies, etc., if they were to suddenly take
over. All right, that's a fair point. Bonnie Greer, does Mr. Pence give you any comfort?
I think that's a yes.
I think I like you, Andrew, but I'm not sure.
Politically?
I'm not sure. Well, if you're into gay conversion therapy, Mike Pence is your guy. If you are someone who believes that a guy can't go into a room with without his wife if there's another woman in there, especially if she's ovulating, Mike Pence is your guy. I can't tell you very much else about Mike Pence. Now, I think maybe other people on this panel can. What is interesting to me as a person of the theater is to watch Mike Pence's body language and to watch him next to the president. He's sort of like the nanny who kind of keeps a lid on things. He's smaller than the president, which is interesting to me as well. And always during the campaign,
what's
his name.
Can I
speak? Can I say something, Piers?
What's his height got to do with anything?
All right.
How big are his hands?
I have no idea. I wouldn't want to see them.
But what does his height have to do with
it? We don't know. Let me explain.
Thank you.
So I actually know Mike Pence. Mike Pence is a good man. He's a moral man. He's a social conservative. He's been a governor in a Midwestern state. He's done an extraordinary job as governor, as an executive. He was in Congress for 10 years, and he was an exceptionally good congressman, and he's going to be very important to the legislative agenda, as Michael Gove said, because he understands how Congress works. So, it's said that the vice presidency is not worth a bucket of spit.
And who said that?
Actually, John Adams, the first vice president, said it.
As well.
But if the vice president, as in this case, or I would argue even Joe Biden, actually has a role to play, it's worth slightly more than
but
that.
But isn't it interesting that the question has to be asked? And that is what I wanted to get around to if I've been given the chance to do that.
Oh, you have now.
No, I wasn't. And what is fascinating, it goes back to this presidency, back to what this presidency is about. And it is about optics. It is about throwing out an idea of a strong man, of a person who can sort of clear out all the things that happened before. And Mr. Pence, I'm glad, thank you for telling me about this, about it, because I had no idea, even though he was the governor of the state next to the one I was born in, Pence is the guy who keeps the break, the lid on things. And hopefully we never get to the point where he does get to be president. But
all right. I want to get some more questions in. Are you looking at me as if you've not had any say tonight, Bonnie? You've spoken more than anybody else on the panel, and I'll send you the timings afterwards.
I'd love to see them. I'd love
Lady
to see
right
them.
In the middle there.
I'd love to see them.
Right in the middle.
I'd love to see it.
I mean, the idea you've been shortchanged is almost as ridiculous as thinking Mr. Trump's an intellectual. Yes.
This question is for Piers, actually. Perhaps you could try to explain to us why Trump said we are going to be at the front queue of the Brexit deal, and now we are sent to the back of the queue because his latest fling with Merkel. Thank you.
We're not at the back of the queue. It's as simple as that. Trump is actually a massive Anglophile. His mum was born and raised in Scotland until she was 18. He'd always told me that his mother worshipped the royal family, loved the Queen. Everything stopped in their household when the Queen was on television. All he wants is to be in that golden carriage coming down the Mall, and we will be, ladies and gentlemen, front of the queue. You know what, Her Majesty? Take one for the damn team. Give him the carriage.
When you say take one for the team to the Queen...
I don't mean that one. I mean, you know, give him the golden carriage down the Mall.
Well, I'm sure that will be... Not a relief to Prince Philip and Her Majesty. Yes, there's a gentleman there, and let me see some questions over here. Anybody there? Yes, and the lady in the front. And I see the chap.
It's another one for Piers, actually, a lucky chap. You were startlingly original in your inquisition of Nick Clegg this morning and your accusation of his cynicism over school fees. I don't think anyone's ever asked him that before. Should you get a chance to interview Mr. Trump again, would you accuse him of similar cynicism, given his vote fast on almost all the promises he's made to his supporters?
Well, yeah,
and do you think the reason he hasn't given you an interview and the reason he gave Mr. Gove one is because of your anti-gun stance and his supporters' support for them?
Okay, well, in answer to that second question, he gave two television interviews in his entire campaign, and they were both to me. And I'm expecting to get the first television interview internationally, just to throw that back at you in your face. Gove is very much an off-camera print guy, in my eyes. I'm very much front of stage, on camera. Clegg this morning, the reason I went after Clegg, and it was quite a long morning, we had Diane Abbott as well, and when you think that me... I thought that we were going to be leading the news all day on Diane Abbott 8 times refusing to say if she would ever countenance using a nuclear weapon or our deterrent. But blow me down if within 30 minutes of leaving our interview, she managed to double down and go even bonkers with Nick Ferrari. And
the subject tonight is Trump's 100 days.
I was asked about Nick Clegg by one of your learned audience, but the point was about cynicism. And Clegg was making this big thing about you can't say that we're all the same, we're all cynical. And I said to him, well, it doesn't get much more cynical than saying you're going to end tuition fees and trebling them. In relation to Trump, the thing I like about Trump is he's not very cynical. I don't detect him as a cynical guy. He's a guy that is actually reasonably straightforward. You know, I found him to be incredibly loyal as a friend to a lot of people I know, including myself, when I was of no use to him on occasion. Always on the phone, how are things, how can I help, blah, blah, blah. That's how he does business, but not cynical. He's a guy who wakes up every morning. You know, I spoke to his campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, who did the first half of the campaign. I said, give me 3 things about Trump that you think enabled him to win. And he said, 1, incredible energy. For a 70-year-old guy, he doesn't need to sleep. Last 6 weeks of the campaign, 3-4 hours a night, and he was raring to go. Secondly, unbelievably competitive. Most candidates, you've got to get them going in the morning. You know, Hillary, you have to wake her up. Trump, he gets up and he's like King Kong. He's already smashing buildings down before everyone's having breakfast. And thirdly, he said he's incredibly fearless. And he told me this great story of being on the plane with just a few of them at the start of the campaign when the Pope whacked Trump over the wall and was very personal. And Lewandowski was like, oh, God. So he went to Trump and he said, look, I don't know how to put this to you, Mr. Trump, but we've got a problem. The Pope has attacked you pretty personally over the wall. So Trump said, where are we going? He said, North Carolina. He said, well, how many Catholics in North Carolina? 12%. He went, so let me get this straight. 88% of the people where we're going don't give a shit what the Pope has to say about it. So he said, that's one way of looking at it, Mr. Trump. Yeah, he said, secondly, he said, hasn't he got a massive wall around the Vatican protecting him? So Trump's brilliant marketing brain had already moved into positive overdrive. And I think it's his lack of cynicism, in answer to your question, that I think is actually one of his Trump cards.
All right. Who's got the microphone? There's a lady here at the front, almost at the front.
Talking of undemocratic despots and the briefing that's been coming out of Brussels over the past few days over Brexit, how do you think he's dealing with the EU Commission, Juncker, etc.? As a Brexit MEP, do you think he can help us drain that swamp?
Ted Mallock, since he hasn't started...
I wouldn't want to make a comment on that, I mean, given my position. No, I think that Trump was, of course, a person who endorsed Brexit both before and after. He's actually said it's a brilliant thing. I think he's a sharp critic, obviously, of multilateral, let alone supranational organizations. I think he's been somewhat reserved, although he did put a couple of Twitter points out on various European elections upcoming, so he hasn't endorsed candidates per se, and an American president shouldn't do that. But I think at one point, President Trump, before he was President Trump, said America would never join such a union.
That's maybe because America is that kind of union in itself.
But well, it actually is not that kind of union.
Well, it's a federal union. But that, don't you think he's already lost interest in Brexit, even in the EU? I mean, isn't that the perennial problem, that he does have the attention span of a gnat?
No, I think the American president, actually, as free leader of the free world, has many arenas to play in. And right now, we have a situation in North Korea that deserves all of our time and all of our attention. And if he doesn't give it that attention, then there won't even be a Brexit to attend to.
So you don't think he's lost interest?
No.
Okay. Couple more people there. Gentleman in the white shirt there, keep your hand up. And the young man down on the front here. If we can get a microphone down, if you keep your hand up, sir, we'll get a microphone to you. Yes, sir.
Sometimes when I listen to people talking about Donald Trump, I start to, if he was a superhero, his opposite would be kind of a sense of ideology, which is non-distinct. It's sort of a bit like, the IMF and the State Department and Hillary Clinton and Angela Merkel and the EU all kind of rolled up with lots of sort of smug ideas where if you disagree with one idea, you're disagreeing with...
It's almost 8:30. We can't have a monologue.
Sorry.
I need a question.
So I wonder how, with the onslaught of Donald Trump, how people who are parts of the supposed institution and the ideology, how they might react and how they might change as a result of Donald Trump.
How the institutions...
Yeah, well,
how the institutions may change as a result of Donald Trump.
Absolutely. So you've got the Democratic Party, as you were saying, lying on their backs, kicking their feet and things. Do you think any of these people are going to start trying to use language that doesn't make them sound like an ideology as such, that makes them an easy target for something like Donald Trump?
Michael Gove, I mean, one of the things that has been a feature so far is that institutions that were meant to go through huge change, NATO being one, the IMF, which has just agreed to the Greek bailout, the World Bank, other institutions that Mr. Trump seemed to want to dismantle as part of the post-world order. It's not really happening, is it?
No. First thing to say is that when Washington Post, after the election, tried to do a post-mortem, why did it get things wrong? It talked to a coalition of Trump voters. One of the Trump voters whom they interviewed was asked, why did you vote for Trump? And the individual concerned replied winningly and honestly, to make sure that the heads of people like you would explode. And I think that there's a significant part of the Trump support that basically wanted the Christine Lagarde in the IMF to be clutching her head in horror and to have the United Nations fearing for their future, and to have had almost every multilateral organization composed of acronyms thinking that Armageddon was on the way. But of course, as we've discussed earlier, Trump in office is different from Trump the candidate. He's more of a realist, pragmatist, dealmaker, and businessman. He doesn't have any of the affection and faith that Stephen described previous American presidents having in these multilateral institutions. He doesn't think that they're the cement of civilization and the protector of the West, but he does recognize that in a limited amount of time, with stuff that needs to get done at home, he doesn't need to play nice with them, but also he only needs to go to war with them selectively, and that's when it is required in order to ensure that those people sitting at home who want to see the odd head explode live on TV can have enough entertainment and enough satisfaction in Trump's performance to feel that they made the right choice.
Are you surprised, Bonnie Greer, that given his rhetoric during the campaign, if you look at the major international institutions, most of which were American post-war creations, the IMF, the UN, the World Bank, and so on, that he's made so little difference so far?
No, not at all, because he doesn't know anything about them. And he hasn't really managed to assemble yet enough people around him who he can trust. Because this is a matter of trust. This man is a person who he has people around him who he can trust. He hasn't got those people there yet. I mean, it may take a long time. It may happen to it for him quickly. But he is a person. He's a man who needs his crew, his posse around him. They're
and
not
he hasn't
there
done
yet.
That yet.
He hasn't. They're not there yet. Ivanka can't do everything. So. I think that when he's able to sort of cast his eye on that with a crew he can bring on that he can trust, we may see changes, we may not. The other thing I want to add is the big problem with this presidency is that we don't have an anchor. We don't actually know where his center of gravity is. We don't know where his fail-safes are. We don't know where his red lines are. That may be exciting to some people, but to, I think, a lot of other people, it isn't exciting. And he is the President of the United States. He has at his command the most powerful military the world has ever known. He can deploy that military at his own will. And I think just basic things like that are the things I think that are worrying the rest
the
of the world.
He used the red line once, and he launched the airstrikes within 36 hours, unlike Obama, who never acted on his red line.
Piers, we're going to do Obama bingo next time I see you and see how many times that comes out of your mouth.
Okay, all right. I think he's Steve all right?
I think he had to.
Yeah?
I think he had to.
Oh, right, okay. He hasn't walked out in protest.
Well, if he did, I thank him.
I'm not even going to go there. Young man down there, yeah?
He's back.
All right, final question.
Yeah, thanks. Actually, following on from that last question, but to what extent does the panel think that the sort of lambasting from the liberal media and the continual outrage from the Hollywood establishment play right into Trump's narrative and continue to drive people into his camp of thinking?
Okay, good question. Steve, as part of the liberal media,
yes, exactly.
Are you doing the proper job of holding power to account, or are you playing into his hands, or maybe doing both?
Well, I just for fun wore a button that says enemy of the people. But look, we're not at war with Donald Trump. We want to cover him. We want to try to be fair to him. We've just done a story, a bunch of interviews with Ivanka Trump, which I think were pretty sympathetic, asking, you know, what role is she playing and what's her relationship like with her father. It's very important. I think, as I said, Trump lives on partisanship, but he also wants to succeed. He wants to be a successful president. He wants to get reelected, and I think it's a big learning curve. I mean, so far there's been a lot of incompetence. I expect that will lessen, and we'll get to know what kind of president he's really going to be. After all, it wasn't until 9/11 that we had much of an idea of what even George Bush didn't know what kind of president he was going to be. It's an intimidating office. And as Trump has rather sweetly remarked, it's a lot more complicated than he thought it was going to be. So I honestly
think... Who would have thought that?
Yeah, I know. healthcare is really complicated, and so is Korea, and so is China. Everything's very complicated. And he says he's really working really hard. I don't know what he expected it would be like. But I think, in all fairness, we have to give him time to figure it out and hope nothing goes terribly wrong in the meantime.
So you're giving him time with your fingers crossed, then?
Yes, exactly.
Michael Gove.
When Adlai Stevenson was running for the American presidency in the 1950s, he was approached by a voter and told, "Mr. Stevenson, you have the support of every right-thinking American." And Stevenson turned around and said, "That's not enough. I need a majority." And one of the things with Donald Trump is that lots of people on the two coasts, as Piers pointed out, in Los Angeles and New York, will condescend and say the man's an ignoramus, a vulgarian, and all the rest of it. But a friend of mine, who's not an ignoramus or a vulgarian, said, in saying that, people in those bi-coastal elites are saying to the American people, you made a tremendous mistake, and they're also missing something else as well, which is that the rage and anger that Trump was able to channel was not rage and anger towards the wealthy, it was rage and anger towards condescension and elites. Mm-hmm. And that Trump is a success, and a success on terms, my friend argued, that working-class Americans applaud. Because working-class Americans think, if I was a success, I'd have a jet with my name on the side. If I was a success, of course I'd carry on eating fast food at McDonald's, because I don't want to forget my roots. And if I was a success, of course I'd hang out with global celebrities like Piers Morgan. Because... That's what money is for. And so when people attack Trump on the basis, as I say, of his poor taste and his poor companions and all the rest of it, what they're really doing is emphasising they're emphasising that they're looking down at the tastes of middle America, and middle America responds by giving them the finger.
All right, we've overrun. We're just coming into the final straight. So, keep your remarks short. We've heard from Steve, we've heard from Michael. Let me start with Piers and go down to Bonnie. Final thought, Piers.
Final thought is, it all comes down to judgment. And Donald Trump chose me as his celebrity apprentice. What more evidence do you need than the man has impeccable, sound judgment?
So I guess we're all doomed.
Well, actually, the day after the election, I was at the basketball in New York, and a guy in the bar, behind the bar, served me a glass of wine. I said, "What do you think of Trump?" And he said, "Well, you know," he said, "he's either going to be the greatest president that ever walked the planet, or we're all going to die." And we don't know, do we?
It's good to end on a cheery note. Colleen?
I think that, like most commercial real estate developers, Trump has a vision of the completed project, and he's on a quest in order to achieve it by any means. And so what we see is someone who will change his means along the way, if necessary, to achieve his vision. So I think that's what we need to keep in mind, his vision of building America great again, infrastructure, organizing Obamacare, tax reform. Those are the big pictures, and whether he completes it or not, we'll see, but he has the energy and the unusual ability as someone who's not a politico to be able to maybe shake things up.
Ted.
So some Trump-splaining. We talked about the lack of a honeymoon. I mean, it's really unprecedented. Trump has faced unbelievable resistance, unbelievable obstruction, opposition on many fronts, sometimes within his own party, but certainly most definitely from the media. Objectively, someone did an analysis of the first 100 days of the mainstream media, and 98% of all media was negative on Trump. So in spite of them, I think we have the possibility, if you want to quote Henry Kissinger, and he's not such a bad source, when he says that President Trump could be a remarkable, indeed, world-changing president.
All right, and Bonnie.
Well, my late dad worked on assembly line making tin cans and steel mill at night for 40 years. And if he were here today and found out that Donald Trump was president of the United States, he'd agree with Jerry Springer, who said, Trump doesn't belong in the White House, he belongs on my show. So having said that, he's not my president, but he is the president. And let's just hope that he's able to keep us safe and keep us all together in one piece. That's all I can say. God help us.
Thank you, Bonnie. So we've overrun by 15 minutes. I apologize for that, but my sense was we had a very engaged audience on this subject. And I thank you all for being here tonight. Our next major event is on June the 7th. It's related to Brexit, but it's actually what will the impact of Brexit be and the French elections on the European Union, not just on Britain, but on the EU. And if you'd like to join us for that, we'll see you. You can also fill in a card, and we're giving away two free tickets. One of the reasons I think you all remained engaged was because we managed to put together such a superb panel tonight. Please give them a round of applause.